And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition, and I use that word advisedly, of The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of magic time between dusk and dawn where the things we hear about, you know, on Yahoo or social media or watching Fox or CNN, and we say, oh, come on, give me a break. This time of night, you know, you need to take another look, and boy, are we looking at something new tonight. Tonight, you know, I've been doing this now for, what, 9 months, something like that? And hopefully we've been getting better. Your feedback has been crucial, and I really appreciate the cards and letters. You know, contact is up at the top under contact info. My name's there, RCH, othersideofmidnight.com. Send me feedback. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. And who you'd like to see or hear, because it's seeing and hearing with radio with pictures. So the essence of this program has been to connect dots. We had, we had James Burke, one of my heroes. We had him on the show talking about the essence of his view of the arts and the sciences and engineering, the connectedness of it all. And we've tried to weave through in our invitations and various guests and discussions that sense of connection, that the stuff in consciousness over there is connected to the stuff in cellular biology over there, is connected to the physics of other dimensions over there, and actually might lead to a way to manipulate reality, starting with something that's incredibly ineffable. That is gravity. What is gravity? Anyway, so this morning's program, if it proceeds the way I think it's going to proceed, which is based on very empirical, easily reproduced data, this program we're going to look back on and say, okay, that was the inflection point. Because if the information that I'm going to discuss with my guest this morning, Dr. Paul LaViolette, is true, and I have zero reason to believe that it's not, it's kind of like a null experiment. It either is or it isn't. In this case, the data says it is. Theory notwithstanding, the arm-waving notwithstanding, the screams of physicists stuck in a 3D Newtonian reality notwithstanding, the simple fact is, as Galileo is reported to have muttered under his breath, it moves. In this case, it being what we're going to talk about tonight. My friend, Dr. LaViolette, has been president of the Starburst Foundation since 1984, where he has been conducting interdisciplinary research in a wide range of extraordinarily intriguing fields, from physics to astronomy to geology, climatology, systems theory, psychology, and ancient mythology. Paul is a quintessential generalist. In fact, he went on to get a degree in systems, you know, theory. That's generalism, kind of academified. Is that a word? Well, it can be. Anyway, he's been doing this and relating, looking at all those dots and relating the dots that normally people working on any particular set of dots miss, because it's now so obvious when you look at the world that the world is so complex that unless you do look at it from a systems point of view, you're going to miss not only the problems, but God help us, the solutions. And boy, do we need solutions out of the box thinking right now. Paul has authored 5 books, could be more at the time of this writing because he's kind of like Isaac Asimov, you know, now. Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, Earth Under Fire, Genesis of the Cosmos, and Subquantum Kinetics, and has served as editor of a 6th book entitled, see, I knew there was one hiding in there, A Systems View of Man. His findings have been published in academic journals such as Earth, Moon, and Planets, Meteoritics, EGS, the Astrophysical Journal, the Monthly Notice of the Royal Astronomical Society, and the International Journal of System Science and Physics Essays. Paul, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. And when you unmute, we can all hear you.
Okay, I'm here.
It gets me every single time. It's like, why isn't this? Scotty, help. Anyway, it's, you know, with that kind of, I don't want to get bogged down in your background and intros and all that. Just go to The Other Side of Midnight guest page tonight and read and read and read and read. Paul is the guy who I've been following quietly. Did you kind of get that feeling of being stared at, Paul? For decades, Because Paul has been like the faithful bird dog, burrowing deeper into the wilderness and the total unknown of political intrigue and black op shenanigans around this incredible concept called anti-gravity and secret government projects to try to crack the code, to control gravity. I don't think it's an overstatement, Paul, to say, and you can disagree, of course, that if we really get a handle on that thing, gravity, civilization itself not only changes dramatically, but it actually gets saved. That it changes us from our present downward, you know, spiral to, as Arthur said, the great primeval sea. And it gives us the means, almost metaphorically and physically, to inflect that curve upward. It gives us the planets, it gives us the stars, it gives us a future, it gives us immortality as a species, it gives us no more putting all your baskets in one exit. And is it real? And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. What do you bring to the table, Paul? Give us a little background in how you got into this, how you thought this fabled holy grail of physics actually was more than a fantasy, the search for anti-gravity.
Well, that goes back quite a ways to 1985. That's when I first discovered Townsend Brown's work. And before that, I had been working on a physics theory, an alternative physics based on the idea of an ether. It's transmuting, more like the chi of the Eastern philosophy. And this theory, one of the things was it predicted a connection between gravity and electricity, that there should be two polarities to gravity, just like there are two polarities to electricity, to charges. And
now,
I thought,
hang on, this was your sub-quantum model.
Sub-quantum kinetics.
Okay,
yeah.
Underneath the ether, the familiar concept of ether, there's a plenum, there's stuffing in empty space, it's not empty. Your model says it's filled with lots of interacting stuff, but it's basically a theory of the ether.
Right. And it has a simple set of reaction diffusion equations. It's just you can write them with three partial differential equations and model them on the computer. And it generates particle-like structures that conform to what they have found with particle scattering experiments. In other words, the predictions of the theory have been verified. And it's made quite a few predictions. It's made about 12 predictions a priori before they were verified. And then the research was published that showed that, in fact, what had been said by the theory was correct, even though it was making statements different from the current beliefs.
The so-called standard model.
Right. And when this was in the development phase, it was before a lot of these confirmations had come through. I was just in the stage of formulating it. I saw that it predicted this connection where gravity should have two polarities connected with charge. And I thought, geez, maybe my theory is wrong. It doesn't seem to match with what physicists are saying. And then I came across Townsend Brown's work, and I saw, my God, it's true. My theory, what it was saying, was correct, because here Brown is presenting the experimental evidence that was swept under the rug.
Okay, so hold it there. What did Brown discover that rang your chimes?
Well, he found that if he charged a capacitor to very high voltage, like 100,000, 200,000 volts.
Capacitor thing we used to find in old radios and TVs, or little kind of dimes or quarter-sized thingies that are sealed, and you charge them up inside. They have plates, and they hold it. They basically hold an electric charge, right?
Yeah, but his capacitors were fairly large, and they were massive. They were like a foot or 2 feet long.
Oh, my God. Supercapacitors.
Yeah, well, very large, and he made them himself with layers of foil and what he called litharge, which was lead oxide. The important thing is that you include a lot of mass in your capacitor.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that if it was charged up, it would actually cause the capacitor to move towards one side.
You mean when you hit it with a high voltage, it would jump? Or when you get initial
impulse towards the positive pole.
So you charge it up and then you discharge it by doing a short across the wires, and physically it would jump.
Well, he just held the charge on the capacitor, and the thing would actually move as a pendulum, would swing towards the positive pole. Then it would gradually subside back to the plumb position, because it turns out that the electrolyte in the capacitor would become polarized, so the initial effect would be lost due to this gradual polarization of the electrolyte. But this indicated that he was able to influence gravity with electricity.
Wow.
Because it worked only if the capacitor was massive. He found a correlation between the mass of the capacitor and the amount of force that he was generating. So this was the birth of electrogravitics. And this is how I got into all this stuff.
And was this like back in the 20s?
When he did it?
Yeah.
He was working in the 20s. He was just a teenager when he was doing his experiments.
And he worked with a professor or someone who worked with Einstein, Byfield, and so it has been called the Brown or Byfield-Brown effect, right?
Right. Initially, he went to JPL, what's it called, Caltech.
Caltech.
It was his first university, and tried to get the physicists there interested, including Millikan, who was a Nobel laureate. And they sort of shunned his experiment. He had it all set up and hardly anyone came. And at that point, he got discouraged and he decided to shift universities, went to Ohio, and met Byfield, who took a close interest in what he was doing. And at some point, because he was showing some of his stuff to the military, they put a secrecy order on him. He was not to publish any articles on this. He had tried to publish article in Physical Review back in the 20s and was rejected because it conflicted with general relativity. he managed to get out an article in what's called Science... forget the title, but it's equivalent to Popular Science.
Scientific American?
No, Science and Invention magazine.
I have some old 1920s copies. Amazing magazine.
They stopped printing way back.
Amazing magazine for the time.
So he was able to disclose all his experiments he was doing, at least, to get that. That was his only published article.
Really?
And I was wondering, why didn't he publish more, until I found in his Project Winterhaven report that was submitted to the Navy. In there, he admitted, there's a one line in which he says that due to secrecy, imposition of secrecy on this, he is not able to publish any papers on this. So that is to explain why. And if he had published about this, I mean, we wouldn't be talking about Einstein today. We'd be talking about Brown.
Amazing.
As far as gravity goes.
Amazing. I mean, really, what he discovered was, A, there's an ether, confirmed experimentally. B, you can build a technology based around electromagnetics, which if you pulse it with enough mass and enough voltage, a la Tesla, you get it to move. It becomes a prime mover. And the theory as to how it moves is kind of separate from the fact that this kind of went into the government through the DOD, through back in the Department of the Navy back then, and it all got classified, Paul? Is that what you're saying?
Right. The most of your major aerospace companies in the 50s were working on this. And you can find this out through a report called Electrogravitic Systems. It was put out by a British think tank. And they were actually, the think tank was involved in catalyzing this whole new industry. They considered it the next evolution beyond jet and rocket propulsion. And,
well, it was the underpinning of the infamous Jetsons car, the flying car.
Right, right. And they had hopes that this would be commercialized and it would completely change aerospace travel. But in the late 50s, suddenly you didn't hear anything more from any of these companies about what they were doing in this field. There were no longer any conferences, public conferences, or articles published, because reporters couldn't get any information to say what's going on. So that was around 1958, 59. So at that point, everything went underground. And there's strong reason to believe that the B-2 bomber used a lot of these concepts that Brown came up with, his electromagnetic flying discs.
Now, you're not saying that it flies totally on anti-gravity, but there's a kind of mixture of technologies, conventional jet engines, plus a little assist from some anti-gravity thrusters or something?
Yeah, well, his electrokinetics was not really influencing gravity. It was what you call an asymmetrical thruster.
Let me stop you there, because that gets into something really, really fundamental and definitional. Do we understand, Paul, your theory notwithstanding, does mainstream physics understand gravity itself?
Because theory doesn't begin to touch it.
Exactly. So when you start in relativity, you hear about space-time and warping space-time. How can you warp something that has no existence? There's got to be something in space-time, some stuff to be able to warp. So that's relativity. Then you go to people like, what was his name, Lesage?
The connection between electricity and gravitation. And here Brown, with a simple experiment, showed, well, electricity can influence gravity and completely disproves Einstein's theory, which says there's only one polarity to gravity, and that's attractive.
So then there is a tunable, malleable technophysics around gravity, which means if you can engineer it, it's something, it's stuff, which means it isn't nothing, it's something. It's a plenum, it's a medium, it's an ether, and it can be engineered. So if gravity can be manipulated, if the ether can be manipulated and the ether and gravity are related, then we're ultimately talking about gravity, even if it doesn't manifest itself like gravity normally does when it's not being engineered.
Hmm.
Yes, no?
Say again.
If the ether is ultimately the source of gravity and gravity itself is being manipulated, then ultimately you're tickling the source of ultimate gravity itself.
Right. Well, you're able to actually influence it with physically engineering things like altering charge on a capacitor. You're able to influence the gravity in the area. And these industries that were going into exploring electrogravitics were inevitably led to the idea of an ether. In fact, Douglas Aircraft had their own ether theory. Brown had his ether theory.
Mm-hmm.
And through a whistleblower who was involved in classified projects, deep classified, he admitted that they view things in terms of the ether. So it's in the classified world, it's a different paradigm from what's taught in the universities.
So as Farrell, Joseph Farrell, which is one of my friends and colleague, and he's been on the show many times, and I've discussed for years, there's basically two tiers of science. The science we get in public, which is wrong, deliberately held as wrong, and then the real science, the inside science, which is now privy of the international corporations, the black ops crowd, the military-industrial complex, everybody who's on the take, the lobbyists. In other words, it's the world's worst-kept secret only because officially no one ever has said over the last, since the 20s, we have conquered how to control gravity. We can manipulate thrust without a rocket, and everything we're doing in NASA and publicly is totally obsolete and a red herring, a distraction from how we really do this stuff and what we've really learned.
Right. I mean, it's not to say that the physics doesn't work in a certain area. You know, it's able to explain a lot of things. But if you think of it as a box, things like electrogravitics are out of the box. And physics would say, well, that's impossible. Our laws would say that's an impossibility. But that's the reality, you know. And the military isn't interested in maintaining physics laws for their own work. They want something that works. But it's to their advantage to have this smokescreen of what's being taught in the universities so that it makes it easier for them to keep secret what they're doing.
How do you take a bunch of graduate students into the complex and get them to unlearn all the wrong, stupid stuff they've been forced to learn coming up from high school and undergraduate and grad school? Because that they're mutually inconsistent. They're incompatible. You can't maintain both reality views at the same time. One is right, one is wrong, and the right one is the secret one.
Well, now with the internet, you know, a lot of people are learning all this stuff, like electrographics, Brown's work. In fact, I've gotten emails from students who are going into aerospace, getting a degree in aerospace engineering, asking me if I could be on their dissertation committee or give a lecture at their university, because they had read my book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, which has gotten a lot of readership.
And well-deserved. It's one of the most fascinating. I keep reading it. It's kind of like one of those books where you read it, and then 6 months later you go back and you read that chapter again. And then you say, oh, my God, I got to go, and you go through the notes, and then you come back. And it's like a never-ending story because it's the story, documented, evidence, folks, that we have been engaged, we as a society, in this two-tiered science for decades and decades and decades. And there's a whole invisible universe of technologies based on this physics that we're never, ever supposed to know is real.
Yeah. And always something happens, higher up, one of the professors or directors of the department will say, oh, okay, this is a little far out. We can't have our students studying this. So basically they're training their aerospace engineers for the 20th century, not the 21st, is what it comes down to.
Well, all right. So, see, I want to set this as precedent because if people understand that their government and all the other things that we're finding out they've been lying about, isn't it incredible watching the political process melt down, Paul, on both sides, and people are suddenly realizing it is in no way, shape, or form a democracy. Voting is useless, pointless. It's being picked, has always been picked, will be picked unless we say no, by a bunch of guys, white guys, in a dark room filled with smoke. Nothing has changed. Well, the same thing goes on in science. And in this book, in this latest book you've got, you document brilliantly how this government has had this control through a variety of different technologies of gravity and reactionless thrust and non-rockets for decades. So with that as the foundation, how did you get connected to the man of the hour tonight, Professor Nausicaus? Because that's got to be one hell of a story backgrounding what you guys have found. Paul?
Yeah, now I hear you. You know, this happened to me once before. I was on a show, and we would continually get cut off.
That's how we know they're paying attention.
And we were cut off 27 times. The interviewer kept track. And fortunately, it was pre-recorded, so he could knit all the things together. That's the advantage of pre-recording. When you go live, you're subject to the sabotage. Seems to be gone
Now. We'll just kind of navigate between the shoals. So basically, how did you and Nausicaus get together? Because based on this long history, your interest in this, to me, it's like of all the gin joints in all the world, what brought you together with the one guy who seems to have had a stunningly simple approach?
I had attended a conference back in year 2001 or 2000 in Switzerland. We were both presenting papers. But at that time, I really hadn't met him formally.
Right.
Then there was an occasion when I was writing my book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, around 2006 or so, where I had been told about his work that would be interesting to call him up. And I did speak to him over the phone. At that time, he was working with, I believe, asymmetrical capacitors.
Okay, what is an asymmetrical capacitor?
Well, Brown had some that he was using. They're capacitors that one plate is bigger than the other.
Oh, okay.
And when you charge them up, you can get a net force on the capacitor that can propel it. And Brown was able to get these asymmetrical capacitors to lift their entire weight plus a 10% extra weight off the ground. It's quite amazing. So he was able to get these things to lift off. So Nausicaa was studying some of these types of technologies at the time, but wasn't having really good results. The next time I ran into him was at a conference in 2012 at the island of Kos in Greece, which where there were different scientists presenting papers on different things, and I was discussing in favor of a stationary universe. Nausicaa there presented paper about his thruster and the experiment in which he tested it. And I had never heard anything like this before, and it was really fascinating. And so got to know him better. And after that, we sort of teamed up. He was looking for collaboration with other people to promote this, to get it moving further, the patent process, and looking for investment, all of this. So I've been helping him since then, so it's almost 4 years.
My gosh. No wonder you were so secretive. I remember, remember when I started the show and when you were one of the first guys I called because I wanted to talk about the development of anti-gravity and the fact that when the government says that they're stuck with rockets and Saturns and Titans and the shuttle, they're lying. They're totally lying. Now, the question is, do the folks who actually are saying that, do they know they're lying, or is this so super black ops that the guys at NASA who basically say rockets and SLSs and, people like Musk and his recoverable first stage and all that, do they really not know, Paul, that there's another totally radically different way?
The people... Which people?
Well, the people that we see at NASA talking about rockets and missions based on rockets and going to Pluto and all that.
No, they know about these other technologies. In fact,
Wait, don't miss that. They know or they don't know?
A lot of them do know.
A lot of them do know. So why are they satisfied with the status quo? And don't answer it. Think about that, because we got to have a break at the bottom here. We will get into the politics, all right? So it's the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Paul LaViolette. We're discussing the mythic holy grail of all physicists and all astronomers and all engineering students. Can we get off this planet with something besides rockets? You're on the other side of midnight, arcing over the deserts of the land of enchantment. You're at the bottom of the hour. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Seemed just like a perfect evening. Get in the car and drive away. Leave behind a day of grieving. Before my life had passed away. I'm on my way. I'm on my way. I'm on my way. I'm on my way.
And we're back on the other side of midnight. It's a little warmer this evening. It's just in the upper 50s, Patrick. Warm weather is heading your way from the land of enchantment. So, Paul, halfway around the planet, you know what's really interesting about this show? The other night, we had one of our participants, Michelle, calling from just west of Tokyo. And simultaneously, we had a correspondent, a guest on the show from Iceland, who was positioned in downtown Moscow. And they both were on this show with everybody in between. So, there are things going on globally, Paul, stunning revolutions, both technological and in other realms, consciousness, metaphysics, whatever you want to call it. This invention, this discovery by Nausicaa and you is so incredibly simple. So let's get into it. Mass is from Denmark, not Iceland. I keep saying Iceland because of the premiere and the resignations and all that. So thank you, Em. Anyway, Paul... What does this mean? If this technology really works, if we can now control gravity at will, And we're not going to get hung up on the definition of this thruster. Does it really do anti-gravity, or is it doing something else? It produces a thrust, and it can allow you to hover. And in the ultimate dream, it can make, you know, even things like airliners and ocean liners, you know, float and move in any direction into space and to the stars and all that. What are the implications for civilization if this is real? And then we'll get to the how we know it's real part.
Okay. Well, there's two thruster technologies that Nausicaa came up with. His first invention is a low thrust device, and that's been tested and shown to work. And now the newer one, it's one that hasn't been built yet, and we have a crowdfunding project to gather money so we can build it and test it. And that will be, all the calculations indicate it should develop huge amount of thrust, able to get things off the ground. If that works, if that experiment, which we hope to do this year, works, this technology would completely transform everything. For example, the space shuttle uses 20 times its weight in terms of rockets and fuel to get off the ground. With this, you could put thrusters in the wing of the space shuttle. Instead of taking off vertically, to take off horizontally, just like a regular plane, just levitate off the ground. The thrusters would weigh about 5% of the total weight of the space shuttle.
Instead of 20 times?
Instead of 20 times,
so
right.
So it's 5% of just the shuttle with the wings, and it just lifts off, and then it flies higher and faster and higher and faster, and then out of the atmosphere, still being pushed by these thrusters in the wings, it achieves orbital velocity, low Earth orbital velocity of 5 miles per second.
Right.
But then if you want to take an afternoon jaunt over to take a look at Mare Crisium on the moon, you turn the thrusters back on, you begin to accelerate again, and in, what, several hours, you turn around and you're going into lunar orbit. Just hours.
Yeah. Yeah, you could design space shuttles that instead of just going into Earth orbit, they'd go to Mars. You could be in Mars less than 5 days, you figure.
Oh, my God.
It depends how fast you want to accelerate.
Well, all right, let's talk about what's called thrust-to-weight ratio. This technology in the first little primitive demo, we're going to talk about that in the videotapes up at the top of Radio with Pictures in a moment. But that little demo weighs, what, 181 grams, I think I remember?
And 118
grams. And the thrust was about 2 grams.
2.2, yeah.
So it's about 0.5% of thrust, right?
About 2% if you compare the thrust to the weight ratio. In other words, if you put it in space, it would accelerate with 2% of the Earth's gravitational force.
Now that's a passive system. That was a permanent magnet in a superconducting engine-like Bell. We'll get to the technology in a second. The Mark II, the next iteration, is going to be active electricity. Instead of a passive magnet, a natural magnet, a permanent magnet, it's going to use coils, superconducting coils around a shape, around a geometry, and those coils are going to be energized so that there's a very large magnetic field going through that geometry. And then you take the power source away, the electricity flows through the coils forever if you keep them cold. And that's supposed to produce a thrust of something like 14 times the weight of the engine and the coils.
Yeah.
Not a percentage of, but 14 times more than something like, I think, 150 pounds of thrust for 5 to 10 pounds of weight of the engine. Staggering. I mean, that's the breakthrough right there, Paul. If you can do that, the world changes. This is the game changer.
And we were making a underestimate purposely, so it wouldn't be too shocking. The space shuttle just does 1.5 in terms of its thrust to weight ratio.
Right.
So this is 9 times greater in terms of thrust to weight ratio.
And the shuttle, of course, is gulping fuel like a lonely swimming pool. And this thruster produces thrust with, this is going to be the part that freaks people out, zero application of energy besides the initial amperage in that coil.
Right.
Which, like the Energizer Bunny, if you keep it cold, it keeps going and going and going. And this sounds like magic. This sounds like Harry Potter stuff. Tell us how it's not.
Well, for the first version, we have the test to show that it works.
Okay, can we go to the video? Let's go to the videotape. All right. So we go to othersideofmidnight.com.
You can also see the images. You want to start with the video?
Yeah, let's start with the video. I always like to start with video. And we want to click on, go to Other Side of Midnight, go to Radio with Pictures, scroll down under My Items. I don't know how we got under My Items, but it's all right. And don't click on the link. Click on the little right-hand video. That's the first one we want to start on, the one on the right. Right?
Okay.
Where it says Athens University.
Outside of its cooling bath.
Exactly. So we can see the guts of what's going on. So yeah. We click on that, click on it again. That will make it bigger. You know, you can embiggen, as they say, full screen. Okay, what are we seeing?
Well, you can see it oscillating off plumb.
What is it? Describe it for those people who are not on a screen. We have this weight on the end of a long string, and it's wobbling back and forth very slightly. The weight is not a weight. It's actually the machine. It's a solid-state thruster doing what and how is it made, and click it again because the videos come to an end. Just do the loop replay.
Yeah, it's a conical superconductor. It's like a casting that's in a shape of a nozzle.
Or a bell, an engine
think
bell.
Think of your garden hose, you know, but it's a, sort of a fat nozzle. And it's got a magnet, a jam.
This is like a neodymium refrigerator magnet?
Yeah. Cylindrical magnet.
Okay.
And we suspend this on a very fine string and find that it begins to oscillate away from the plumb position. It will swing away and then come back, but it never swings to the other side.
Okay, tell us what that means. Because people watching are not physicists, so we have to be really, really stupidly simple for me and them to know exactly why this is so phenomenal, because it just looks like something swinging on a string.
Well, it means it's got some thrust causing it to move away from its plumb position.
Okay, and you got to keep hitting the replay.
And the reason that it's swinging is because when it starts off, it develops momentum, and that carries it past its equilibrium.
Okay, here's my first technical question. Why in this test wasn't it held deliberately off plumb at an angle so the thrust balance the couple of the weight of the force of the object, the 118 grams, so it sat there with the pendulum stretched slightly to one side so you saw that angle but it's not moving?
I've never tried that. You'd have to physically touch it.
Yeah, of course.
You got it just balanced,
and then it would just sit there at an angle.
Yeah.
That seems like an obvious thing to do because your forces should be balanced.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other thing I want to underscore here is when you set this up, you got this little bell-shaped engine, this miniature thruster, and the cylindrical part on the left is the magnet, the neodymium magnet, high-strength magnet. Is it important to put it in the thruster in a certain orientation, in other words, south-north, north-south?
We usually put it in a certain orientation, but it should work either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you cool this down with liquid nitrogen, that little bell shape is made out of a particular alloy, a particular metal oxide combination that goes superconducting when you get it below the temperature of liquid nitrogen, right?
Right.
And at that point, that's when the motion starts, but not before.
Right.
So if you've got lots of liquid nitrogen around and the thing isn't cool enough, there are critics who say, oh, it's just the outgassing of the liquid nitrogen. But if that was true, then it would swing when you begin to apply the nitrogen, not when it's cold. And then there's another test that he did, right? Which is he took the magnet out of the bell, but had everything super cold under liquid nitrogen, and it does not swing.
Right.
Without the magnet. Go ahead.
And the other thing, when this warms up, and you can see it right at the very end, you see it's not swinging very much. That's after it warmed up.
So when you cool superconductors below a certain magic temperature, they go superconductive like flipping on a switch. And then when you warm them up, they lose that magic ability to conduct the electricity forever, and they go back normal, and the current goes away. You're saying when the current stops, when it's quenched...
That when the superconducting ability is gone, it stops swinging.
Which means the force that's making it swing goes away.
Yeah, and you can explain it in relatively simple terms what was causing this. This is what's called the Meissner effect. It's the ability of superconductors to exclude magnetic fields from penetrating through them. And this creates a force between the magnet and the superconductor. And it's what we use for maglev, for trains or whatever. But with maglev, the magnets are attached to the rails and the superconductors are in the train, underneath the train. So they're not attached to each other.
Okay.
Which means you need an infinite number of magnets along your rail to keep this thing afloat. Now, what Nausicaus has found is a way to put the magnet onto the superconductor and still get a Meissner effect force that can, in this case, propel it.
Okay, now let's go back to Radio with Pictures. Let's click on the left-hand video where it says Nausicaus Thruster Larissa 2014. Make that bigger.
Yeah, here he's putting the superconductor in a container that's filled with liquid nitrogen.
A little styrofoam box, I guess.
Right. And suspending the whole box in pendulum. It, again, it's doing its oscillating motion.
Which means there's a force emanating from that little cone-shaped nozzle with the magnet in it, a force that should not exist, and a force that goes away when you either warm this up above superconducting temperatures, meaning it goes normal conducting, or you take away the magnet.
Right. And now here, because you've got everything inside the box, you can't make any admissions that it's due to bubbles from the liquid nitrogen pushing on the thruster.
Yeah, you know, jets of some kind coming from the nitrogen evaporating. It's in a closed box, and it still
to
is swinging.
That possibility.
Yeah, under a force.
And if you track towards the end of the video, that's when he's showing that he's taking the magnet out from the thruster, and he puts just the superconductor in the box and hangs the box again. And then without the magnet, the thing isn't going to work. It turns out it just hangs there in a plumb position. So that pretty much proves
okay,
the point.
Now, the essence of science is something called peer review, which means, and I think this came from the creation of the Royal Society back in the 1600s, you have a bunch of guys that are supposed to know the same stuff you know. You find something new. You present it to these guys that know the same stuff that you know, and they're your peers, and they're supposed to basically say, oh, he's found something that, based on what we know, we don't know, but we should find out more. That's peer review, in essence, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a lot more bureaucratic, and there's being knifed in the back, and people want to suppress discoveries and all that in the real world, but that's the theory. So why has not this process been, quote, peer-reviewed to where this little simple demonstration, which is impossible under any normal interpretation of Newtonian laws that we understand, is not making headlines in the New York Times? You did get physicists from Cambridge. You did get a bunch of people up to and including a Nobel laureate to look at this, and their conclusion is?
Yeah, he agreed that developing a thrust.
Well, that's earth-shattering. That's paradigm-shifting. That is a disruptive technology. Why isn't this on the front page in the New York Times tomorrow morning?
Well, we've been concentrating more on the patent process. The patent was issued just, when was it? February.
Of this year?
Of 2015.
Oh, okay, a year ago plus. Okay.
And we've been looking for investors. We've been doing... Last year, we did some demonstrations to various groups, like at the University of Athens, mm-hmm. to be honest, you know, neither of it. Well, I hadn't invested the time to work with Thanasi to write a paper in English. His English needs some editing help. Because I've known through experience how long it takes to get published something that is going to challenge several laws of physics.
You mean in the mainstream scientific literature?
Yeah. Both of us, you know, are doing this on a shoestring. You have to understand. We don't have a laboratory where we can do any kind of experiments we want. We have to get facilities, agreed to be able to use facilities at a certain time. And, you know, just there are a lot of experiments we'd like to do, even take this to NASA and fly it in their vacuum chamber, which can go down to 40 Kelvin or lower. And we predict that this thruster could produce even 10 times more thrust at lower temperatures.
You mean in liquid helium as opposed to in liquid nitrogen?
Well, 40 Kelvin is like it would be in space. Liquid helium would get even colder. But the colder you get, the more the ability is of the superconductor to prevent the fields from penetrating, which means you'd be developing more forces. We can talk about this by reference to some of the other diagrams.
Yeah, let's spend the rest of this half hour talking about the next stage in the project, because you have to build the big thruster, the one with the maybe 150 pounds plus of force for maybe 5 or 10 pounds of weight for the engine. And once you get that demonstrator, which is roughly $30,000 to $40,000, you've got an Indiegogo project up there. If you look at link number 2, click on link number 2 tonight in Radio with Pictures. That takes you to the Indiegogo support page. Paul, tell us about your campaign to get people to help with the next phase of this development, because everything depends on this next phase.
Yeah, well, we need $32,000, which would go to pay a company, which is a major manufacturer of superconducting coils, to wind the coil. It's a special conical-shaped coil that would also to test it in liquid nitrogen. So that's the cost of that. To test it in liquid helium would require another we want mainly to demonstrate it in liquid nitrogen first.
The reason those two things are so expensive is because it's really hard to handle liquid helium because it's so incredibly cold and it's a very tiny molecule and it wants to escape more easily and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, with liquid helium, your door is double-walled. It's got a liquid nitrogen door around it, and the liquid helium is inside that. And they're fairly large. I mean, they're several feet high.
Well, wouldn't it be more economical looking down the road at production vehicles based on this technology if it would work really cool, pun intended, at liquid nitrogen temperatures? Because it's so much easier to keep things at that higher temperature than it is at super cold temperatures. Super cold temperatures would be places probably in space where you have nothing but that to worry about.
Right. If you really want high thrust, you could use liquid helium in space, and you could have even a heat pump to get your temperature down to that level. But for getting it off the ground, liquid nitrogen should be fine.
And that's all you got to do is prove. I mean, I can see this thing almost like a hoverboard, where you get a guy or a teenager or a girl, and they just stand on it. You plug the 9-volt battery in, and you know, comes down to current and down to temperature, and then it just kind of takes off and hovers. It's like a hoverboard.
Yeah, you would just pour your liquid nitrogen in the capacitor in the doors of your hoverboard. And energize your coils.
So you're about, if you go to the Indiegogo page, you're about a quarter of the way to your $32,000. And as we said, it's flexible because if you get more money, you can do more experiments and convince investors. And that's what's going to take this off. Pun intended, terrible pun. You need investors for the next phase after the demonstrator to basically get it to take off.
I've already been approached by a number of people that say they can bring us investors. So that this has helped by getting this publicity through the crowdfunding campaign.
Now, are these individual investors who are in the business of raising money, or are they people in areas of technology? I mean, to me, this is natural for Musk. He sets up another division. He's already talked about how, you know, the Tesla 3 is a space vehicle, a spaceship. You marry this technology to the Tesla 3, and you can basically take a Tesla 3 and put it into Earth orbit and bring it home.
Yeah. Well, I did send an email to his email box. I haven't heard back yet.
Well, I'm hoping after this show, because remember, we reached places last night again, Tokyo, Moscow, same show, same time, a half a planet around. I mean, it's amazing who you can reach now, and you're not limited by local control, by local broadcast horizons, by local, you know, limited power. We literally reach the world, and whether you reach the right person, a lot of times it's the whole Kevin Bacon, you know, the six of degrees of separation. People who know, people who know, who people who know Musk, and say, hey, you got to pay attention to this. I heard this, you know, that kind of thing.
Hmm. We've had NASA, some people in NASA are interested. We had one guy who was associated with the NASA Advanced Innovative Concepts Program, who requested that we keep him informed of our progress.
Okay, I'm sure he is.
You know, that indicates definite interest in what we're doing.
How difficult is it for Nasikas to make his first one? Because it looks to me like it's basically just a little shaped piece of a material which will go superconducting when you put it in liquid nitrogen.
Well, he didn't make it himself. You have it made by a company that knows how to make these things.
Okay. And
they're not cheap, I'll tell you.
So how expensive was that little...
About 2,000 euros. That's about $2,500.
Okay.
Make one. And, you know, we're working from basically our Social Security checks. And as you know, you've heard the news about Greece, you know, the cutbacks, you know, and people's pensions are cut. So, you know, it's not like we're exactly rolling in cash.
Well, that's why I want to really push the campaign tonight, because if you guys can assemble 32 grand, which is not much in terms of R&D and development of this magnitude. This is such a stunning development if it can be confirmed that 32,000 is nothing. I mean, you and I both know people we could go to quietly and say, put money in this. But you've made the decision, as I made the decision when we talked about doing the show, I want our audience to individually participate. The more people who at the grassroots make this work, the more ownership, both moral and legal, there is for not being able to stuff this back in some, you know, huge room like in the Indiana Jones films, where all these incredible discoveries wind up never to be seen by living souls again.
Yeah.
This must be guarded against, and the way to do that is through crowdsourcing, and that's why you're a quarter of the way there and you basically have had no high visibility, right?
Right. We had our own email list. I had several thousand people I sent out to, and it had an initial very big spurt, and that sort of died down since then. And so we're hoping some more visibility through radio broadcasts will boost that up again.
Well, it's interesting because I had a call, when I say call, email, from a friend of mine in New York who happens to be a major owner of Salem Broadcasting, the network. And they want me to tape something on Friday talking about this technology and Nasikas and you and the developments and the Indiegogo campaign and how we can get to the next level, because they understand how important this can be. And Salem reaches millions of people, Paul. You should be prepared to have to up that goal, because I think we're going to get you a little bit more money here.
That's great. Yeah, well, the second version, I just heard about it myself just last fall. Nasikas had been keeping it secret from me because he applied for the patent, and there was a certain period where his patent lawyer told him not to say anything until we're sure it's gotten filed and everything. And at that point, we were deciding, well, let's go forward with this second version, because if it works, then we don't need to worry about the first version. Well, the first version still would have a lot of application in space. You know, we showed surprisingly, well, something I didn't mention, that first version, even that 2.2 grams of thrust, it turns out that if you took five of those pitiful little thrusters that you see demonstrated here,
right,
it equals the same as the NSTAR neon ion thruster that NASA used to get the spacecraft, the Dawn spacecraft, out to Ceres. So here, these are thrusters that you can hold in the palm of your hand, compared to that huge thing that you can see in the picture there. That's a picture of the NSTAR thruster on the right.
Right.
Compared to the one on the left, which is an Acacus Thruster 1, the first version. And you see there's an immense difference of weight. The NSTAR requires 500 kilograms of fuel to take it out to Ceres. Plus, it weighs 30 kilograms.
500 kilograms is roughly what, 1,300 pounds?
Half a ton.
Half a ton of fuel.
Yeah, the spacecraft itself weighs 1.2 tons.
This is the NASA spacecraft, the Dawn spacecraft. I tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Paul LaViolet. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we will get into the nuts and bolts of theory. How can this work in apparent contravention of the physics that we think we know? Have we been kind of misunderstanding the physics that we think we know? Or is this a subset? Is what we normally think of as Newtonian mechanics a subset of a much larger unified set of laws, in which case it's all bets are off? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. We're back on the other side of midnight on this morning, this Thursday morning. Thursdays are one of my favorite days. I wonder why. Thursday. Anyway, my guest this morning, Paul LaViolet, we're discussing anti-gravity, the control of the ether, even if it isn't, quote, technically anti-gravity. So let's dive into the deep end of this lonely swimming pool, which has been fueling the rockets of yesterday. How does this work? How does sticking a magnet in a superconducting nozzle, or making a nozzle geometrically and then winding a superconducting coil around it and putting current in the coil, how does that wind up with this puppy leaving like a homesick hummingbird trying to get home?
Well, if you look at the diagram on the right,
So we go back to radio with pictures. Okay.
You see that horn-shaped...
Hang on. Yeah. We have to scroll down to your pictures, Paul's items.
Yeah, number four and number three, they're essentially the same thing. But here on four, you can see I put some forces in. The magnetic field near the magnet is very strong. So inside the throat, the magnetic field is very strong. But the return flux that goes outside the thruster and loops around, it's going to be very weak out there, spread out. Now, the Meissner force on the superconductor is pressure on the superconductor. Superconductor is preventing it from entering, and that creates a force.
When you say entering, you mean penetrating the metal, penetrating the geometry of the engine.
The ceramic of the superconductor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that force is going to be much weaker on the outside surface and much stronger on the inside surface.
So it basically shapes the field. The geometry of the superconductor, the engine bell, the truncated pyramid, whatever geometry you want to call it, plus the magnet, that magnetic field cannot penetrate the superconductor because of the Meissner effect, which means the geometry of the throat of that little engine is shaping the field.
Exactly. It acts like a barrier, and it develops a net force. And if you do vector analysis, you'll see that there'll be a residual force directed towards the narrow end that will propel the thruster towards its narrow end. In other words, the forces perpendicular to its axis will balance out, but there'll be an unbalanced force because of the angle of the throat. There'll be an unbalanced force to the right.
Did Dr. Nisikas have enough money? Because I know Greece, I mean, the idea of this is coming from Greece with their incredible economic problems is just, that's just kind of mind-blowing in and of itself. Anyway, did he have enough money to make more than one little, you know, nozzle with different geometries? Is the angle of the throat important, or have you guys not got there yet because you don't have enough funding to experiment?
I think he did experiment a little bit with two different angles. You should talk to him about that. I don't have that.
Okay, because that's really cool. Because the angle of the motor that he's going to create, this levitator, this hoverboard, you know, engine, it's going to have a very shallow angle of something like 3 degrees.
Yeah, you're talking about the second version.
Yeah, the second Type 2. Yeah. Mark 2.
Right.
The one with the current and the coil instead of the solid-state magnet, the permanent magnet. Why only 3 degrees?
Well, because that's superconducting tape that's being wound around to make the coil.
Oh, it's geometrically has to think it's sitting on a cylinder, and you can kind of fake it.
You don't want it to crinkle. You know, if you have too much of an angle and you try winding a band, like a ribbon, onto a cone, you're going to make a crinkle in it. So the company felt that 3 degrees was tolerable. They could wind it and should be able to lay flat enough with that angle.
Now, did you get that paper I sent you the other day? There's been a breakthrough in superconducting wire just in this week announced. Exactly. Why don't you tell folks why this is such a stunning breakthrough, coming just at the right time where this breakthrough is needed to make this hover car, hoverboard, hover anything work?
Well, they're able to get much higher magnetic field intensities due to the ability to get much higher currents flowing through the wire.
And what about the geometry of the wire?
Instead of having tapes like we would be using,
like which are flat, long and flat,
a regular round cross-section wire, very fine fiber.
So if it was found by Nisikas that actually you want a 52-degree cone or you want a 19.5-degree cone with round superconducting wire, this breakthrough, announced just this week, able to conduct much higher current before the field breaks down, you can make any engine shape and wind the wire around it as a coil. So this breakthrough goes hand in hand, and this is the way you develop real space drive engines, again, if this works.
Yeah, you're able to go to steeper cone angles with that, and higher currents and higher magnetic field intensities. Now, that version, it's working on the principle of the Lorentz force, as it's called. It's the same force that causes an electrical motor to turn when you put current through the coils and you have a magnetic field in the vicinity. The magnetic field and the current interact with each other to produce motion, which turns your motor. And the physicists use what they call the right-hand rule to explain how these are all related to each other. So the same happens in these superconducting coils, and the designers know about these Lorentz forces because the forces will tend to try to expand the coil. So they have to make them design, in fact, these tapes, superconducting tapes they use for the windings, have some sort of steel in there to strengthen them, so keep them from breaking apart when they're energized. Now, the typical coils, they're made as cylinders, and you wouldn't observe the force we're talking about in a cylindrical coil. But if you wound it as a conical, slightly conical shaped, you find if you do the vector analysis, there'll be an unresolved component of your Lorentz force, which will propel it axially towards the narrowing end of your coil.
The small end.
The small end.
Okay.
And in fact, we did the calculations using the software at that company, which is the same software they use to compute the magnetic fields of their coils based on the currents they can put through them. And you multiply the current by the magnetic field intensity in the vicinity of the windings, and you come up with the value of the Lorentz force and do your vector analysis with the 3 degrees angle, and you come up with 66 kilos of force.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is a pathetically small test coil. I mean, we're not winding it like your major coils that they can wind. We're just
how big across is the is this truncated disc that's going to be wound?
It's about 16 centimeters, I believe.
Okay, so 8 inches, nine inches?
Centimeters, couple inches tall.
8 centimeters. Wait a minute.
Eight inches by 2 inches.
Oh, okay. That's tiny. You're going to get 100 and almost 200 pounds of force from something that small.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to worry about this not collapsing your coil. You know, make sure it's strong enough to.
You mean just physically in terms of the coil and the forces on the coil? Well, that's just building it out of sterner. So you could make it much heavier and stronger and still have a huge weight to thrust ratio.
Yes.
I mean, this is an engineer's dream. This is my friend G. Harry Stein years ago, who was a protege of Robert Heinlein. I'm going to talk about Heinlein in a second. G. Harry Stein wrote a novel decades ago about a garage inventor, kind of like you and Nasikas, in his garage, who's tinkering around with technology, you know, and sparks and high voltage and all this, and he creates an anti-gravity machine, a drive. Yeah. And he's a private pilot, so he sticks it in a Cessna, and he makes the mistake of not realizing this thing is going to take him up into space, so he's going higher and higher, and suddenly realizes, I can't breathe, there's no oxygen, and he has to come down there. You know, in other words, you got to build a novel with excitement and all that. The point is, this is what he was envisioning, because it's so incredibly simple that even if you just gang the solid-state versions together, you could produce really industrial-level thrust. Right?
Yeah. The solid-state, you mean the first version?
The the permanent magnet and the geometry of the bell. You know, you just make a whole bunch of them.
Well, still, it's the thrust-to-weight ratio. So the first one is not going to get you off the ground.
No, I'm talking about if the Mark II doesn't work, which, of course, there's no reason it shouldn't. But if it didn't work and you only had that little thruster, you put that into orbit and you're halfway, as Heinlein said, to anywhere.
Right. In fact, you can go to the nearest stars.
Hang on. Let's go down to othersideofmidnight.com. Let's go back to Radio with Pictures and let's scroll down to these are graphics tables, number 7 and number 8. Okay.
Yeah.
Number
the
8.
Seven, I'm comparing it to the version 1. I'm comparing it to the neon ion thruster.
This is the NASA ion thruster powering the Dawn spacecraft to Ceres.
Right.
Okay.
And if you do what's called thrust to weight ratio.
Right.
It turns out this pitiful little Nasikas thruster is putting out 1,000 times more thrust per unit weight.
That's shockingly, weirdly wonderful.
And it does it without any power consumption. You see there where it says power consumption zero.
No moving parts?
2.5 kilowatts almost. They have solar cells to gather the sun's energy to energize the thruster, which is basically rocket technology.
Yeah, it's just shooting electrified particles, but it's still Newton's third law, second law, action, reaction, all that. Let me read you from Heinlein, because this is so, and M found this for me last night, and I'm very grateful. Every technology, Robert said, goes through three stages. First, a crudely simple and quite unsatisfactory gadget. Second, an enormously complicated group of gadgets designed to overcome the shortcomings of the original and achieving thereby somewhat satisfactory performance through extremely complex compromise. And finally, the third stage, a final stage of smooth simplicity and efficient performance based on correct understanding of natural laws and proper design therefrom. The Nausicaa's thruster pole is stage three of Heinlein's three stages. It's the essence of simplicity because it understands in a little piece of hardware that costs $2,500 how to tap into the ultimate force of the universe, which is the flowing, moving river invisible we call the ether.
As Tesla would say, tapping into the wheelwork of nature.
The wheelwork of nature. So, do you want me to go first with telling you how I think it works, or do you want to go first with telling me how you think it works?
Okay, let's hear your theory.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Well, I think it's all about fluid flow. I think it's ultimately fluid flow, and the reason it works is because it isn't a closed system. The Meissner effect is really a means to an end. It's not the end in itself. What it's doing, and that's why I asked you the question about polarity, I have always heard that magnets have a flow, that the flux enters one pole and exits the other pole. So, and that the Earth's orientation relative to the other planets is backwards. The Earth's field is backwards, like we'd flipped upside down compared to Jupiter, compared to Saturn, compared to Uranus, Neptune, the big planets with fields that we can measure. Mars doesn't have a unified field. But the planets we can measure, we're the odd guy out. So it looks like we have flipped in some time in the past, so our north and south are opposite. When you do that conversion and you find out which side of the magnet the flux, this invisible flux, is entering and then leaving, if you put it in this little engine, if you take this ceramic material, which gets superconducting when you cool it down to liquid nitrogen, and you put in the right orientation your little magnet inside, it's basically the Meissner effect, and the bell is constraining the flux of the ether, which is what the magnetic field really is, into flowing in a Venturi rocket kind of action-reaction thing. So you're basically reacting, according to Newton, but in the ether and not in anything visible in three dimensions.
Yeah, well, actually, Dr. Nausicaa has envisioned it also. In fact, the equations for magnetism are identical to those for fluid flow of a mechanical fluid. And in fact, he has envisioned it in conceptually in those terms. You can think of this as like your garden hose, the nozzle of your garden hose, and where it's not very well attached. And if you turn on the pressure, the water pressure, the thing's going to go flying off, because the pressure inside is greater than the pressure outside.
Right.
So your magnet is like generating the garden hose pressure.
But you see, there the conventional physics thinks magnets are in and of themselves separate entities, whereas this thruster behaves like the magnet is part of the medium. It's connected to the ether. And guess what, Paul? There's a 200-year, I think it's 200 years old, maybe it's 175, something like that, year-old experiment by a guy named Faraday.
Exactly.
The homopolar generator. Talk about fixed magnetic fields, fixed space, rotating when you shouldn't get a current, and how that connects directly to this incredible invention.
Yeah, that the magnetic field, through what Faraday demonstrated hundreds of years ago in his experiment, he was able to show that the magnetic field, even though it's generated by the magnet, it's rooted in space itself.
Yes. So that, it isn't generated by the magnet. It is transduced by the magnet. It's conducted from an invisible medium into our perception by means of the magnet itself, but the magnet doesn't generate the field.
So what that means is that the magnetic field can then exert pressures on your superconductor and move it relative to itself.
If it's shaped in the right geometry. Right. It's the geometry, Bill Clinton.
It takes along your magnet, and the thing is like a bootstrap effect.
this thing would want. Did you see the proposal earlier this week by Stephen Hawking and the Russian billionaire Yuri Milner? They want to send a whole flotilla of tiny nano satellites to the stars using conventional technology and just boosting these little tiny chip-sized spacecraft up to 20% the speed of light.
Well, they should use the Nausicaa thruster.
Well, obviously. I mean, if you turn this thing loose in space, how long, and I guess that gets us back to radio with pictures, how long would this little thruster, the first one, take to get to the stars? So we go to what?
Graph number eight, years here for this version.
Link number eight, right?
Yeah.
Click on link number eight, radio with pictures. You got it right down there. Time to reach Proxima Centauri, which is the little white red dwarf, which is orbiting in the Alpha Centauri system, 4.3 light years away. With this technology, 20 years a generation. With conventional,
as opposed to 18,000 years for the NASA's proposal using a solar sail thruster.
Now that 20 years is just very arbitrary because you're dealing with only the little Mark 1 Nausicaa thruster and its thrust to weight ratio, right?
Yeah, we're assuming that we can get five times more thrust at interstellar temperatures, which we think is an underestimate. But we are we're assuming a little greater thrust than what we demonstrated in the laboratory. So if you compare it here, by the time you get to Jupiter's orbit, we can get there in 21 days, whereas with the solar sail, it would take 16 months to get that far. At Jupiter's orbit, our thruster would be going 708 kilometers a second, whereas the solar sail would be going only 70 kilometers per second.
So 10 times.
10 times faster. But this one keeps accelerating, where the solar sail, they drop the sail out about where Jupiter's orbit is because they don't get very much thrust anymore.
Look at that. At 200 AU, which is roughly what? It's roughly 10 times Jupiter, Pluto's distance?
3 times the diameter of the solar heliopause.
Yeah, Pluto's about 40, about 40 AU away. So 40 into 200, it's roughly what? Five times. Five times.
Well, you're in interstellar space when you're 200 AU.
But here's the point: it's taking New Horizons 15 years to get out there to look at its first Kuiper Belt object at that distance. It would take this Nausicaa thruster technology and a CubeSat less than 5 months to get to five times farther away than Pluto.
Yeah, because you keep accelerating with this.
And until you're halfway, and then you slow down. You turn it around. Now, this gets us back to radio with pictures, okay? Let's go to radio with pictures. Click back to the main page there. And click down under My Items, Paul, to the two last cartoons I wanted to post tonight, which are from Dick Tracy. Click on the left one, number four. This is 1946. Dick Tracy, Chester Gould, invents the magnetic air car, which is this technology in a conical bucket that the cop stands in and rides all over town on this thrust, looking at, rooftop surveillance, finding the bad guys, whatever. Then you scroll down, and in 1962, he invented something called the moon car. And each of those little cup nozzles is a similar kind of gadget, which is what we would have with our spacecraft, because the only way you can control this, Paul, is to maneuver multiple sub-engines around because you can't throttle it down. It's either on or off, so you have to put these opposing little engines so their thrust is against each other. Since it's free and infinite anyway, they don't care. And then you rotate them around just like the moon car to go up, down, sideways, rotate, swivel, hover. I mean, it's like Gould anticipated what you guys have found by decades. Or was he privy to a black ops project like Jack Kirby? I'm serious, Paul. I'm serious. Because I have been finding that more truth is coming out through the comics and the cartoons and the Marvel Universe epic tentpole movies than are coming out in any mainstream publications.
Well, I heard of some whistleblower claiming about underground laboratories out at Dulce, and they were saying that they have elevators there that are driven not by motors but by magnetic thrust.
Which is this?
Makes you wonder, you know, do they have what we're talking about?
Okay, my next question then is, Kamerlik Owens, who is a distant relative on my father's side, I think, Swede, you know, in 1911, discovered superconductivity by cooling mercury down. Remember that? Well, you're not quite that old, so you won't remember that. But
no.
But then, from then to now, why isn't Seekus the first guy to think of putting a magnet in a superconducting shell of a thruster, the cone, to see what happens? Is he the first guy in almost 100 and some years to think that this has to be done this way? That's astonishing.
You have to overcome a lot of resistance, conceptual resistance, because you're trained to think, well, these things are impossible. You shouldn't be able to get anything to behave this way. So there is that pressure that you have to overcome. Nausicaa had his theory that he was working on called the minimum contradictions physics, which is sort of a theory of theories of what is the best approach for physics. And the best approach is to have the minimum number of internal contradictions, if possible, to make the theory as elegant as possible. And so he started developing this approach. And one thing about the approach was that it was saying that matter and space-time are interconnected, and that is everywhere, that all the space-time fabric, he calls it quantum space-time, which is an equivalent concept to the ether, that this is everywhere and it forms everything. But it means that you really can't put a boundary around a superconductor, that that superconductor is intimately connected with its surroundings. So as to where does the energy come from, you can say, well, it can come from the hidden level of the space-time, whatever is going on there.
Well, if you're bootstrapping yourself in an invisible river, if the magnet, because of Faraday, we know the magnetic field is not in the magnet, it's in space, and a coil-like generator rotates and produces current regardless of whether the field is moving, whether the coil is moving mechanically past the field or not. It all seems to wind up that the field has to be in space and the magnet merely ducts it into our reality. So if that's true, then you could take this technology, scale it up, make it a little more efficient, maybe make it out of something lighter. And in other words, even Mark I, as what I call the solid-state device, high-strength permanent magnet and superconducting bell, that to optimize that technology and then make a million of those and send them to the stars, it's not, you don't have to wait next week. You can do it. If you have $2,500, you can do it tonight.
Exactly. Yeah, we have the technology now to do this.
That's crucial. This program, you've got to tell everybody, we're not waiting for the $30,000 to prove this works. We're waiting for the $30,000 to prove it works to all the idiots who are going to look at the other thruster and think of every weasel-worded way not to acknowledge what they're seeing, because they don't want it to work.
Yeah. We're figuring with the second one, if we can get the second one off the ground, it will be something no one can deny when they see something lift off the ground.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's such a shocking thing.
Okay, before we go to break here, we're coming up on the bottom of the third hour here, the second hour. Go to number 13 on Radio with Pictures. That is the actual diagram of the test that proves that this is all real. And so focus on that while we take a break, and we'll come back and we'll describe this and why you two can do this anywhere on the planet. Liquid nitrogen is everywhere. Gloves are everywhere. Protocols are on Google. You can have somebody make this stuff. It's not that expensive to change history, to recover history, to understand what you're doing, to be part of a movement, a revolution, a physics revolution. This is something in your own garage you want to really kind of think about seriously. And Dave Distler, our EM Drive friend, is actually doing exactly that and will be reporting soon. You're on the other side of midnight. We're at the cutting edge of something that could change everything. My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. and we shall return.
Thousand miles across the ocean, the land of seas against the sand, lies a beach of mixed emotion. You made me king of this land. This heart has come from beyond the grave.
And we're on the other side of midnight tonight, and believe me, it never made our tagline at the end of the evening more appropriate, because this can take us to the stars. Tomorrow night, Paul, I have an author on, Walter Bosley, who's a friend and colleague of Dr. Farrell. He's written a book called Origin, The 19th Century Emergence of the 20th Century Breakaway Civilizations. And he traces with exquisite documentation the same kind of research level that you've exemplified in your pursuit of this anti-gravity secret, you know, government technology since the 20s. He's pursued the idea that a lot of the anomalous airship sightings in the late 1900s, particularly across the United States and in Texas, and a lot of other things connected with the Civil War and secret black ops projects starting in Prussia and in pre-Nazi Germany, that all of this coalesced to find ancient documentation of this kind of technology that was not lost, that was preserved, and that's why we have the emergence of stunning anomalous things before we should have invented the stunning anomalous thing. So that's going to be tomorrow morning following this show, to demonstrate that there are uses, there are things we want to do with this. By the way, as we've been talking, I understand people are actually clicking on the Indiegogo site and they're sending you money.
Right.
How much? And from whom?
Well, they're modest contributions. We did get one $35 or $25 contribution. So we've had contributions up to $1,000.
Fantastic.
For $1,000, but most of them are 100 or less. And we have a suggested minimum. If people don't have money, they can at least not to leave before they contribute at least $5. You know, they figure their time is worth more than $5 just to read what we had to say. You know. In fact, we had something like 5,000 people come in the first 6 days. And if each of those had given...
Yeah, we lost you there on Skype.
Oh, I was saying we had 5,000...
Ah, they did it again.
The first 6 days. And if they all had given at least $5, we would have gotten the total amount we needed.
Well, it takes a while because there's this incredible innate, oh, come on, this is too good to be true. That's why I go back to Heinlein's three laws. This is the quintessence of understanding how the universe works and building a technology which is geometric to get that uneven flow in the ether. And bingo, and the commonality between this approach and the EM drive people who are using, you know, microwaves, magnetrons stolen from microwave ovens, and they're building sealed cones out of copper, and they're got waveguides, and they're dumping in certain frequencies, gigahertz frequencies, and they're looking, and they see a teeny, 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 tiny amount of thrust, and this is 1,000 times or 10,000 times bigger, and there's no moving parts.
Yeah.
It's so Heinlein. Oh.
Ours produces 10 times more thrust per unit weight. It's possible that the EM drive people might be improving their device by using superconducting foils on the outside.
Yeah, that's what Roger Scheuer, who was the guy in England who actually came up with this technology. He worked for apparently a communications company, maybe Hughes, you know, working on satellites, and he noticed an anomalous effect because of the thrusters. They have ion thrusters on some of these things. And he noticed there were anomalous celestial mechanics motions. And that, according to the story, is what led him to try to do this in the ground. We've got a caller, our friend from down south here, Torch. Let's add him to the conversation and find out what he wants to know. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing pretty good. What do you think?
Oh, it's very interesting.
Are you going to build one?
I already got one.
You've got one?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, don't do that. You cannot do that because they'll come and they'll take you away and we'll never find you.
Yeah. Hey, I know about those 11 B-2 bombers that you're talking about. They do have 11 of them that they built with the device in the wings. I actually sent a picture of one of them. My question is how is this engine going to work in space where there is no gravity? Anti-gravity is all fine and good when you have gravity to deal with, but when there is no gravity, how is this going to work?
Oh, see, that's the devil is in the details. Paul, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I wouldn't call this anti-gravity. It's it produces an unbalanced thrust. It's producing a force, actual physical force on the superconductor. It's the Lorentz force.
Okay.
So,
of course, you know that your critics are saying that explanation is wrong. I looked over at the NASAspaceflight.com thing, and they say that those forces would be totally contained within the superconductor on the surface, and you need some unbalanced force vis-a-vis the ether. So that's why I hit you with my explanation, because we know from Faraday the field is stuck in space, and so this basically constrains the flow of energy that is a magnetic field in the ether into a certain geometry, and you get a reaction, but it's not in the atmosphere, it's in space itself, it's in space-time, it's in whatever term you want to womp up for that plenum that carries reality.
Yeah, but that's still just going the distance. What you need to do is to fold space and time and actually warp into...
Hey, I'd be perfectly happy to be able to get to Pluto in 2 weeks with this. Because once we get there,
their technology there, we're not dealing with warping space with this technology.
Well, you are, but at a very small level. I mean, obviously, if you're warping a field, the reason the geometry works is that you're changing the parameters of space on one side to the other side of your device, your engine. You're just not warping it at a level that anybody would pay attention to.
Yeah, that's good for a solar system. It's not good for interstellar.
Okay.
No,
well,
this is fine for interstellar. If you put that first one out in space, it will continue to accelerate on its own.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to wait the 5 years, you know, turning around and all that. He wants to have... By the way, let's hold off on this question because it has to do with communications. Let's bring in Darren. Darren, you want to add something?
Well, I was just going to say, if the government has had this technology all along, shame on them. I mean... We pretty much ruined our planet with all this fossil fuel technology that we've been using. If they've had it for 40 years, that's just ridiculous.
Paul?
Yeah. In fact, this thruster can be applied for generating electricity.
Oh, tell people how you do that. That's so cool.
You put four of these thrusters around like pinwheel fashion, and you generate torque on a shaft.
So you spin the shaft up. The shaft is sticking into a generator. You can use that for conventional magnetic, you know, flux coils and electricity generation, voltage, and all that. So this thing basically is a perpetual energy generator that will generate electricity on any scale and run forever if you keep the damn coils cool.
Yeah. Pollutionless. Yeah.
Can you imagine, like 200 years from now, they'll think back to the 1900s and you know, and beyond is just the time that we really screwed things up.
Well, I don't think we screwed things up without a lot of help. I think there are people, we're going to talk with Walter tomorrow night about a group who basically have decided we're not good enough to have this. They want us to die. They want the planet to implode by restricting technologies that can solve problems until it's too late. Look, Ma, they were so dumb and stupid, they just committed suicide and we couldn't help them. Plausible deniability.
By the way, we just got a $100 contribution.
Fantastic.
Where do you donate? Is
oh, okay. Go back. Go. All right. Link? All right. That's my job here. We go to othersideofmidnight.com. That's our homepage. Click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. That takes you to the guest page. Simply scroll down on the guest page where it says Richard Items and Paul's Items. And right below the two videos of the demo, of the superconducting motor demo, there are some links. The first link, number 2, under those joint videos is called Support Superconducting Levitation Thruster Project on Indiegogo. You click on that, take you to the Indiegogo page. There's a huge write-up with links and connections to the patents, to the physicist testimonies, the peer review, the actual video of the demonstrations, and the plans for the Mark II thruster, how much it costs and how much has been donated. It's so incredibly transparent. And this, there's so few times when you can be asked to do something that's going to really, really change everything. And this is one of those times.
Yeah, especially if it works in a bigger scale, just a little bit bigger scale, just like you said, and everyone will just have their minds blown, I have a feeling.
Yeah, it's called a disruptive technology. So, Torture, yeah. I'm going to goodnight you because I want to bring Sean in. And Darren, if you have nothing or something.
Nope. Hey, great show. Thanks, guys.
Okay. So, Sean, let's have what you want to add to the conversation. You're on.
Yeah, I think you would need to add Ian Fleming to that list of list of people that may be in on it as far as Walter's conversation tomorrow, but also with regards to the machine tonight.
Now, who should we add?
About a car that that flew.
The car that flew.
Yeah, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah, Disney.
Ian Fleming wrote that book.
Wait. You're telling me James Bond, Ian Fleming, wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Yes.
That means he has to know about this technology.
That's what I'm saying.
Paul, what do you think?
I don't know. Who knows? This is one of the applications to make cars that fly.
Yeah, look, we got 20 minutes left. Sean, why don't you hang around for a sec? Paul, limb out a vision. Limb out a future. What can this not solve if we put our minds to it, given that we know it works? There's no question it works. We just need something big enough to convince all the idiots that don't see that demo and say, oh, it's working. So we need something that they can see. Once we get to that level, which is in months now, we're not talking years, decades, we're talking months, what will you expect to happen? What's stage three? What's the next political step?
Well, do a media demonstration. You invite the media to observe the thing working. And
oh, my God, you're right. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was written by Ian Fleming, the magical car.
The question always is, what did he know and when did
exactly.
he know?
Exactly. And I'm not going to sort that out tonight. But anyway, Paul, yes, the vision, the future, what does this do? How does it remake the world?
In air travel, like instead of taking jets, we would have air buses that would lift off the ground vertically and travel at high speed to across the planet. It would open up space exploration. Travel to the planets. We have our own vehicles, like in The Fifth Element. You can imagine cars that fly like that.
So we will have the Jetsons space car.
Yeah, you could imagine cruise ships, again, Fifth Element, the cruise ship that floated in the air. Even trains, you could have trains floating above the track if you wanted, or even go anywhere you wanted, actually.
I think traffic control, air traffic control, takes on a whole new meaning. You know, talk about amateurs. New caller, we've added you to the conversation. What would you like to add?
Yeah, I've got a quick question for Paul. The base material of the cone shape, is it relevant in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, we use IBCO, and not all of the high-temperature superconductors work as well.
Are we talking for the Mark I thruster or the one where they're winding with the Mark I, the solid-state one, as I call it?
Right, because there's some versions that develop what's called pinning, where they're situation like if you've seen pictures on the internet where the magnet and the superconductor get locked into a lockstep with each other. So if you move one, the other one moves right along. You don't want that effect, if possible. You want to minimize that effect. And some superconductors that they're making maximize the pinning effect because that's what they want. So we don't want that. So there are some tricks. We haven't said all the tricks involved.
Oh,
so
it's just the beginning. I mean, again, we're back in terms of this technology. You're back at phase one of a superconducting thruster level of understanding, right?
Yeah. Now, for people who want to reproduce this, if they can just be patient, because there are things that we will be releasing later about how to do the experiment properly.
You know what I would suggest, Paul, being as arrogant to suggest something to people who've discovered the secret of changing the world? How about an executive toy? How about setting up a production line? I've got folks that would probably invest to do something so we get a copy of this on Ted Koppel's desk, we get a copy on Donald Trump's desk, we get a copy on Obama's desk, and it just sits there and it hovers and it hovers and it hovers, and as long as they keep filling it with liquid nitrogen, it just hovers.
Well, there are some room temperature superconductors.
Oh, there are?
Yeah. In fact, there's one fellow I was put in touch with that he's not ready to disclose his research till he gets it more refined. He wants to do more research on what he's doing, but he believes he's on to ceramic combinations that are actually superconducting at room temperature.
There was a guy at Stanford decades ago. He wrote a very seminal article in Scientific American. That's where I saw it. I think his name was Livingston, not related to David Livingston, who's a part of this show. But he was at Stanford. He was a physicist, and he was looking to create room temperature organic superconductors, because his theory was that the reason DNA carries information across millennia so easily, it's a superconductor at room temperature.
Hmm. Yeah. So we'll see this evolving into devices that you can operate at room temperature and, like you say, put on somebody's desk.
Well, that's the way to democratize this. In fact, what you ought to do for people kicking in like $1,000, they ought to have some little trinket, something that sits and they can wow their friends on the coffee. And seriously, I've got marketing people.
I've thought of that. You know. What you're saying, we weren't ready to be manufacturing and distributing these and telling people how to do the experiment yet. We want duplication, but we want to... There's some patent issues. We want to file patent on the first one. If it turns out the second one works, there might not be any need to file patents on the first one.
Oh, but I like the first one because Heinlein's third law. It's exquisitely simple. It's elegant. You make it in the right geometry. It's got a beauty to it. It's inherently what the universe is doing. And if you released it in the right way in space, like, for instance, if I was able to book for $200,000 a trip on Branson's first space, you know, missions, right, suborbital arcs, and I took this little puppy up there and it's sitting in my lap and we're up in zero gravity and we're arcing over, we got a 5 minutes of zero gravity, and I released this thing, solid state, no reason to have anything other than a super cool jacket around it, self-contained with super insulation, it will migrate, it'll move totally sealed to the cabin wall or the front or the top or the back on live television.
Mm.
That's the power of that little tiny thing if we can multiply it by a million times and get people all over the world to say to their friends and their folks and their family, how the hell is it doing that?
Well, the other thing is it's a very nice toy to take to a physics classroom and demonstrate that the standard laws of physics don't apply to superconductors. You know, like energy conservation and Newton's third law. So that in itself will change physics, I believe. Physics will have to start admitting that they've been overextending the application of these laws. That they're good for refrigerators, but maybe they don't work universally.
See, tomorrow night we're going to have Walter Bosley on. He's going to talk about how this technology may have been preserved by some secret groups in our past from a previous high civilization epoch. And so there are folks that knew about this long before Nasikas figured it out. And, you worked with him and long before Townsend Brown and all that. That's tomorrow night. On Saturday morning, our imaging panel gets back together. We're going to look at some astonishing images from around the solar system of ancient artifacts left by this Type II civilization plus its descendants. And we now know there's a technology, Paul, that if we marry this to a CubeSat, you can kind of buy off the shelf a CubeSat, you could send your own spacecraft with control and everything to Pluto in 2 weeks to go into orbit and look at this stuff up close and personal, and then you could bring the spacecraft home, refurbish it, and send it somewhere else, and then somewhere else.
You cut to NASA's budget dramatically.
Who cares? NASA's budget has been wasted for the last 50 years basically pretending that all the amazing stuff that's really out there, Paul, is not out there, and it's time they got some competition.
Hmm.
And this is, we can do this ourselves. This audience can basically, when you get the Mark II done, and it has, you know, 20 to 1 times the thrust-to-weight ratio, that's the level of technology to take us to Pluto in 6 months, counting development time. Because basically, this is basically just a vectored thruster that you rotate around. You probably will want to make 2 of them so you can get vectors and get quantities. And as I said, to control it, it's on and off. So you have to physically swivel them, right, to get thrust variations.
Right, right. You so, to gimbal them.
Yeah, you have to gimbal.
At least,
you know,
3 of them.
But that's incredibly stupid engineering. We have a million people that know how to create mechanical gimbal systems. And when you get into space, you don't need the liquid nitrogen because you put a parasol up, right? You hide your spacecraft behind an umbrella, shield yourself from the sun. Your temperature goes down to 40 Kelvin.
Right.
Liquid nitrogen is liquid at what, 140
Kelvin?
77. So you're well below liquid nitrogen. You don't need liquid nitrogen, although you probably want something as a fluid to even out the fluid distribution in your mechanics. But you've got the stars. You've got a spacecraft. You could make it. You know, CubeSats are kind of cute. You could gang 2 or 3 of them together. You could add instruments. You could miniaturize instruments. In other words, this is only the beginning of the conversation, Paul, because we're at the end of the second hour. We have to go away.
By the way, we got a few more contributions, 3 more in the last 5 minutes came in.
And there will be more when they don't have to listen. They can click, and it's super conducting levitation thruster at Indiegogo. That's link number 2 and the other side of midnight, radio with pictures tonight. And so in the few minutes we have remaining, what are your plans for when the Mark II thruster works? What are you going to do then?
Well, like I say, we'd do a press conference and get more visible exposure on this.
I presume in New York.
Probably.
Yeah.
And we would want to be licensing this. Hopefully the patent will go through that we've applied for. But we're ultimately looking to license this to different for different applications and get it implemented as much as possible without hopefully any suppression. You know, so it'd be worldwide. And, you know, there's no reason that this should be restricted just to defense applications. I mean, you could look at it like the automobile. If they had a chance to classify the automobile, they would have done it. We wouldn't drive cars, you know.
That's an interesting idea. Would they, Paul, would they really have done that because it gives people, what, too much freedom?
And they say, well, geez, we could use this in warfare. We don't want this to be generally known. We don't want our enemies having the automobile because they'd be able to more easily defeat us. Fortunately, the Black Project system wasn't set up at that time to that level to cause that kind of suppression. So we are fortunate to have the automobile.
And now we have social media, because if you do this right, if you raise the money the way you're doing it in Indiegogo, you can't crowdsource this and then stuff it back in the bottle. It's never going to wind up in that huge vault with the Ark of the Covenant and all the other stuff that Indiana Jones found. This is going to democratize it. And then, as I said, there are people waiting in the wings who I think I can introduce you to, who I think have the vision to take this to the next level.
Mm.
I mean, this is just, there's no limit to what we can do, because we already know it works. Look at those pendulum videos, folks. Look at them carefully. That is proof, if you understand the proof.
Have you seen the JPL travel posters?
Yes, yes.
It's Route 66. It's
Totally. You know, right through the land of enchantment.
You know, this is the future is now.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, Sean?
No, that's it, except for would being near a volcano affect this effect or have an effect on this effect, I should say?
I don't think so. You have to keep the thing cool. Liquid.
Why would you want to be near a volcano?
in changes with the magnetics.
Yeah, you want to ideally, there is an orienting effect. The thruster orients towards the north, just like a compass. The field is not strong enough to cause any deflection of the pendulum, but it can orient the thruster. And that could be a nuisance if you were using this to fly. You wouldn't want your spaceship to be tending to go towards the north.
So, yeah, but wait. If you're doing this on Earth, it's reorienting itself relative to the Earth's field itself. In space, you'd be using the ambient field.
Right. But you can neutralize this just by putting magnets opposed to the field in your central magnet. Just put outline magnets that don't affect your thruster.
So it looks like the moon car with all those little paddles twirling around, gimbaling, facing this way, that way. I mean, it's going to be an amazingly interesting control problem.
The other thing is, if you reverse the field in the magnet, you still get the thrust in the same direction. So you can have two of these, one with the south inside and the north out, and another one with the north inside and the south out, and they will neutralize the effect of the interaction with the Earth's field and still develop a force.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, we've got to do more hands-on experiments once you get this raised. So, back to Other Side of Midnight. Look at Radio with Pictures, link number 2. Click on the Indiegogo campaign. You know, Paul, I've had a lot of guests since the time I've been doing this show, but I must say that tonight I can say, as I've never been able to say before, because of your work and that of your colleague, Dr. Nisikis, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.
Make it so.